Welcome to Clarity Lab, where I talk to leading health and science experts to educate, inform, and dismantle misinformation. And if you are a human on this planet in 2025, you probably know what a problem misinformation is. I'm Derek Barris, and Clarity Lab is the official podcast of Cyrus Health, a 501c3 nonprofit I founded to build a free educational platform and curate social media channels that feature experts presenting health and science in a clear and compelling manner. And since we are a nonprofit, all your donations are tax deductible, which helps support our mission. Please visit cyrushealth.org to learn about what we're doing and what we plan to do in the future. And if you can support us, we would greatly appreciate it. If you've listened to the Environmental Working Group, you would know that parabens are toxic. And then you should wonder why you were listening to the Environmental Working Group. Every scientist and researcher I've talked to over the last few years are very concerned about EWG's fear-mongering and outlandish claims. Which leads us to today's episode about a topic I know very little about. Cosmetics. Thankfully, I've made other friends who really know what they're talking about when it comes to the chemistry of cosmetics. One is Jen Novakovic, science communicator, cosmetic chemist, and host of the EcoWell podcast. Jen worked for a decade helping brands develop formulations, acting as an R&D liaison, guiding claim substantiation, and fact-checking marketing copy. Her niche expertise is in environmental sustainability, which includes eco-design in R&D, substantiation, and regulatory compliance. I wanted to know the real deal about parabens, and thankfully she provides that during this episode. We also discuss how EWG manipulates public sentiment by manipulating data and studies, natural versus synthetic cosmetics ingredients, sunscreen myths, and how cosmetics are formulated. I learned a lot by talking to Jen, and I hope you do too. All right, Jen, I wanted to talk to you because there's a long-standing trend in wellness spaces, especially around clean or natural beauty products. And the general idea is that certain natural ingredients are healthier than and better than laboratory-derived products. And from my point of view, this adds to the general feeling of chemophobia that we often see in wellness spaces. I would like to start with a 30,000 foot picture of this. Can you walk us through the product formulation process?
So from my point of view, as somebody who's done product development as the chemist, and like maybe this would look like something different depending on where you are in this value chain. I'm now doing more technical consulting, so not in this role anymore, but previously an indie brand would come to me with a product brief. They would tell me exactly what they want, if they have a specific ethos in mind, if they have a retailer standard that they would like to comply to. Clean at Sephora is really big, especially for indie brands, because that's typically where indie brands want to be sold. Then they'll tell me about their ethos, tell me about the claims that they want to make. So that could be anywhere from an ingredient claim. They want to say that they have a specific percentage for, say, vitamin C, or it may be something more specific for efficacy, so hydration. And then throughout that process, we'll talk about, well, what level of proof are you looking for? And that'll tailor the direction we go. I get this brief, I start making formulations, then I'll send it to the brands, they'll try it, and we'll go back and forth until they have a formula that they're happy with. So I just worked as a cosmetic chemist making technical details that they can then transfer to a contract manufacturer. Throughout the process, actually, I'm doing stability testing. So in between my formulation rounds, I'd put it in an incubator to make sure that everything is holding up. After that, though, then we would get to working with a contract manufacturer who may or may not have in-house testing capacity to do, for example, preservative efficacy testing or skin sensitivity testing. If they don't, then we have to outsource. So there's a bunch of safety testing that has to be done to make sure that the product is going to be safe, because by law, you can't launch a product regardless of the jurisdiction. You cannot launch a product that is unsafe for consumers, and all claims on a label require evidential support. Otherwise, you can get in trouble. You can get in trouble from a regulatory standpoint, but also, especially when you were talking about the United States, where you have a very litigious public. If you get in trouble, that's also potentially going to translate. Not to mention the public stigma that your brand is now going to be facing, but a lot of money with like class action lawsuits that are just continuously happening in the United States. It's a big risk. And actually, interestingly, brands who are sold in the United States, I have brands that are coming from Canada and they want to sell in the United States. So when they want to be sold in the United States compared to any other market, their insurance rates go up because of that risk for litigation in that market. So we go through a bunch of safety testing, then there's like scale up testing, and then they start doing the contract manufacturing runs, and then that is beyond where I am. And so that will look different for somebody who's then in the contract manufacturing space, actually getting that to a distributor, getting that to the different retailers, and so on and so forth. But from my vantage doing formulation, that's what it looked like.
The process you just described where you're involved, how long would you say on average that takes?
It really depends on what the brand is looking for and how picky they are. What it looks like to me doing custom formulation will look like something different if they're working with, say, contract manufacturer. It's very common for them to have kind of base formulas that then just require a little tailoring. So a formula like that, you can have done right away if you like something that they have in-house. So private label, little modifications, maybe 2 months for the formulation work. And then you have safety testing on top of that. For me, the typical process, like 6 months, 3 months, very short. If you have an easygoing client that is happy with the initial iterations, I'd say 6 months is kind of the average. But I've had clients that it's taken like a year or so, which I mean, honestly, is not that slow. And then you have to do safety testing. So then the minimum length for that would be about 3 months in addition. Yeah, you have to do stability testing in about 3 months to make sure that your product will be stable for about 2 years in an incubator. That's how you do the testing. So that whole process is going to be anywhere between 1 year, but more realistically 2 years.
Now, the last time we talked when I was on your podcast, we discussed the naturalistic fallacy a bit. And that's really why I wanted to have you on here, because there's this fear of chemicals, which I flagged earlier, chemophobia. Is there any sort of differences between the quote unquote natural or clean beauty products and, let's say, general run-of-the-mill Sephora products that you would get? Let's say something like, I use a lot of my lotion is CeraVe, which is a very mainstream brand, for example. What are the actual differences, and do they actually make a difference for people?
No. If not, it might be, a negative difference. And, you know, it really depends on where a brand is coming at the idea of clean, whether or not they're leaning towards more natural ingredients or whether or not the new trend, because everyone realized you can't actually get the same kind of performance that many consumers are used to with just natural ingredients, especially all natural ingredients. So the new trend is there's a few synthetic ingredients that are fine, actually. They're totally safe. These ingredients are allowed. It really depends on where you're going to come at it. I would say if you're using more natural ingredients with this assumption that the natural ingredients that you're using instead of synthetic ingredients is going to be safer, that's just false. Clean really depends. You're going to limit the preservatives that you use. You're not going to be able to use, for example, more robust, well-proven preservatives like parabens. So you might be left with more allergenic, less skin-safe preservatives. Typically, for example, at the Clean at Sephora standard, you can't use parabens, which is arguably the most skin-safe preservative option for formulators. And you can use it at a very low level and it's very safe. So you might be left with a preservative that fits within that standard that is potentially more irritating. You have to use it at a higher percentage, which translates to a higher risk to consumer, not to mention a higher price tag, because that preservative itself is more expensive, and the fact that you have to have a higher input level also adds to the price tag of the product. If you're coming at it from a natural standpoint, natural ingredients aren't inherently safer or more environmentally friendly or better performing. And there are so many examples of this. I don't want to denigrate all of naturals, because there are many natural ingredients that are great to work with, but they are, I would say, inherently challenging compared to synthetic ingredients because of the comparatively lower safety substantiation available for these materials and the complexity, because there is so much variability from ingredient supplier to ingredient supplier. So this just creates a challenge for brands as they're thinking about safety substantiation. There's also a layer that among the natural ingredients, there's a lot of allergens. If you look to the fragrance allergen list, many of those allergens are very common in natural ingredients. So allergenicity is a challenge. But coming back, the complexity. So here I'm thinking about a really great example of this would be within the extracts, where one extract inky name, so the ingredient that you see on a label, may represent many different sources, many different processes, many different supply chains that may or may not have been adequately looked at to make sure that there's not adulterants. Adulteration is very common within extracts. And then you get to the stability of the formula, because these ingredients also make it really challenging to get to a stable formula. And I think for the clean beauty aspect, though, there's just so many different meanings of clean beauty. And so it's hard to even like nail down an answer there, because it really depends on how the brand is defining it. And even consumers, even retailer standards, they're all kind of different, because the claim itself isn't regulated. So it could mean whatever brands want it to mean.
You mentioned parabens as being safe, but that's not what I read on the Environmental Working Group website. Why is that?
So they think it's unsafe. I actually don't know if they actually think this, but they've come to this conclusion with what they've published based off of cherry picking poor quality early studies that are correlative and discounting the rest of the literature. Then they've taken that and then went to say parabens are unsafe. So a lot of the fear for parabens, and previously until I did a blog about the EWG like 8 years ago. I did a review of their methylparaben skin deep database entry, and I highlighted what they had done then. And then since I had highlighted it, they actually changed the references. So they obviously saw it and saw my critique. So earlier they were citing the 2004 Darber study. I don't remember all the specifics, but that was how they initially landed on this idea that there is a risk for breast cancer. I believe Philippa Darber in this study had 30 breast cancer patients. I don't even remember how she came about the result. I think everyone was exposed. There was no control. And so with correlative data, seeing like everyone who has breast cancer use paraben-containing products, therefore they had estrogenic effect from the parabens. Okay, so another example of this kind of logic that she just used is, if I go to a beach and I'm eating ice cream, then I'm going to have a higher risk of being eaten by a shark or being bit by a shark. Did the ice cream make me get a higher risk, or is it because maybe there's more sharks? I feel bad using that example because shark attacks are so rare, but like that's a common example. Just because there's a correlation doesn't necessarily mean that there's a causation. Then there's been further in vitro studies where there wasn't estradiol in the scenario, which then after I had noticed that they had used this within their references. So they found that by in a petri dish, you can expose the estrogen receptor to parabens, and then you would see an estrogenic effect. But they didn't have estradiol in that environment. And so in a human, then you would have to outcompete estradiol in the human body, and parabens are about 10,000 times the most estrogenic of the parabens that are approved for cosmetics use are about 10,000 times less estrogenic, less potent, less capable of getting in this receptor compared to estradiol. So the likelihood of them actually out competing in a human environment is very low. So they used in vitro studies to say there is a risk for breast cancer. And they've ignored all the other literature that overwhelmingly supports safety. At this point, parabens are some of the most well-tested ingredients in cosmetics, and the overwhelming body of literature, even when considering the aggregate exposure of parabens in products, overwhelmingly supports safety. So they've just went frustratingly, actually, I'll just say, in their skin deep database, they had actually one risk assessment by the SCCS. I think they may have even included one from the CIR. In their statements about estrogenic impacts, they had some of these poor quality studies. And the last I checked, it went up to 2008, but it was an in vitro study. And then they had the 2011, at this point, SECS opinion on parabens, which is way better quality evidence. They just had a lower in their entry, not relevant to estrogenic impact. And like that piece of data was way stronger than what they had to support the estrogenic link, but they just like ignored it. Seemingly they read it if they included it in their data or in their entry, but then they just ignored it. So they've just had blinders to come to the conclusion that parabens cause breast cancer, which is false, or cause a slew of other issues. So another thing that they'll say is that it's not skin safe. And they're ignoring the fact that amongst the preservative options, it is a really good option for skin irritancy. So good that the American Contact Dermatitis Society in 2018, I believe, it might have been 2019, they won the non-allergen award of the year. And it's because compared to many of the other preservative options, they do really well. And so I'll often hear this idea of like, we're going to go paraben free because we want to have the cautious choice. We're just being safe. We don't have all the data, even though there's like over 1,000 studies at this point. How much more data do you want? And also, do you know what that means when you're asking for more data? It's probably going to mean animal testing. People don't realize that that's what they're asking for when they're looking for more testing. But you're willing to then opt for something that has like way less data. So you're just choosing the option of ignorance. Ultimately, that's how EWG landed where they are. They just cherry pick data to confirm what they already had to say, which is just a red flag for pseudoscience. That's not how it works. That's not how science works.
I'm really thinking about all of the ways that fear around preservatives cut across these lines, because preservatives and food dyes are different ways of making foods shelf stable is a big thing recently in the MAHA crowd. And then we're talking about preservatives here in cosmetics. Can you just explain why, at least from cosmetics, from your area of expertise, you can't just put things on the shelves that don't have preservatives in them?
Because if there's water, even if there's not, they will go moldy. Or like other bacteria or microbes are going to be introduced. Like you don't live in a sterile environment. It's just going to happen. And then once they're introduced, they may grow in that environment, and then you have an unsafe product. The biggest public health risk for cosmetics is microbial contamination. You can go blind from a contaminated mascara, and that risk is a lot greater than the risk of the inclusion of, say, parabens at the regulatory limit, which for some is like 0.3%. That risk of microbial contamination, much, much greater. People have died from microbial contamination. So that is the risk. And so that's why it's very important to put preservatives in products, even if they don't contain water as well, because there is moisture in your surroundings. So commonly I'll hear people say, if the formula is anhydrous, then you don't need a preservative because microbes require water for them to flourish. But then they fail to see the cases of lipsticks blooming with microbes, which happens very often. And therefore, even in that scenario, you should put a preservative in the formula just to be safe.
In your field, you took a particular interest in combating misinformation, which not everyone who works in the sciences has to. Why did you decide to do that?
I think it's because I was preyed upon when I was younger. When I was in my undergrad, this all started from a boyfriend that I had in my undergrad. he was really into the paleo movement. First, I was doing a zoology degree, and then I doubled up my degree with a nutrition and nutraceutical sciences degree, which was like, we took a lot of pharmacology courses. You'd think I would have had my head on straight to like think more about this stuff, but he had some compelling things to say, and I had yet to develop a sense of critical thinking, I guess. There was a lot of schools marketing to undergraduates as like, you could do this with your undergrad. Naturopathy was one of them. And then also I was contemplating becoming a dietitian, but then the conventional dietetics or whatever is like killing people, because I was there. I was there. And so then I went and I actually did a school for natural nutrition. I'm embarrassed about this, but this really changed my life and how I thought about this. I did that right after I had finished school. Amazingly, I was also working as a science writer, and it's just like the disconnect was real. But I went through this. In the first class, every reading was just novels by holistic nutritionists that had only done like 2 years of a diploma. And now I'm coming from like one of the better nutritional sciences programs in Canada. Like I could see what they're saying was wrong, but I pushed through and I'm like, oh, maybe it'll get better. And it didn't. It just went downhill. And it was a total eye-opening of how predatory the wellness space was. So about $6,000 later, I mean, I was fresh out of school. I was not rich. So it was a huge hit to me. And then I changed gears and then went to cosmetic chemistry. But I had that experience where I was preyed upon. And then I also saw other people within the wellness sector, which I did have a little stint at. And watching people who were selling kombucha, telling people that this can help prevent cancer or cure cancer. So just like seeing this in this little gap between my undergrad and before I went to back to school doing cosmetic chemistry was eye-opening, that misinformation, especially in the wellness space. I've now kind of shifted towards environmental misinformation, but it's just so outrageous and has such a profound impact on so many people's lives. For me, it was me as a student just wanting to do something with my life and wasting so much time on this program that was just garbage.
I'm glad you're doing it. Final question, what are the biggest myths surrounding cosmetic chemistry?
The myth that I'm thinking about for cosmetics is like, for cosmetic chemistry specifically, is that everyone thinks that their product performance or their initial reaction to a product is from this like extract or so this fancy oil or whatever the fancy ingredient that's marketed on a label. People think that that's why they like the product initially, especially when we're talking in the first week. The main reason why people like the product, the main contributor to your first initial aesthetics experience with the formulation, is actually the surfactants, the emulsifiers. The emulsifiers are the primary drivers of aesthetics for, like, for example, how you rub it on. Is it going to feel greasy or light? It's not the shea butter, for example. I hear so many people say, oh, it's the shea butter and I know that it's going to be greasy, or there's petrolatum, it's going to be too rich for my skin. Those ingredients can be fine if you use the right emulsifier system. So that would be the cosmetic chemistry. The top cosmetics misconceptions, that natural ingredients will be better, safer, more environmentally friendly is the thing that really, really bothers me, because like, this is very important for us to pursue producing products with less environmental impact. And then when people think the wrong things, then we end up making products that are more environmentally impactful. And that's actually what I'm currently studying for my PhD. I find that equation very interesting to see how brands are responding to misinformation from consumers and retailer standards. Other misconceptions, this idea that, oh, it bothers me so much that people think that mineral sunscreens are first safer, but more environmentally friendly. Like, that is just not how that works at all. Zinc oxide is actually very intensive to produce. And then the fact that you require a higher input of the filter compared to chemical filters actually drives up the environmental impact. So like, it's not better in terms of coral damage. Actually, sunscreens across the board, another misconception, are not supported based off of the evidence to actually contribute in nature to coral bleaching. But like, outside of that, from like a life cycle perspective for this finished product, these products are actually more impactful. So you think you're buying a product that's more environmentally friendly. I hear this all the time. And actually, this is ingrained in, I forget what it's called. Sephora just launched this like Planet Aware. I think that's what it's called. Climate Aware, Planet Aware at Sephora. And their stipulation is that there's no chemical UV filters and that you can only use mineral sunscreen because that is purportedly more environmentally friendly, which is wrong. It's wrong.